Okay. As you can see, we have two titles here, but it's actually going to be squished into one thing, but it's going to be separated across two people. We're not going to necessarily present the results from Indonesia and from Pakistan separately. They'll be kind of compared and put together. We also want to kind of talk a little bit about the overall things that went into this whole study. We've heard a lot about what's been going on in Lebanon and Egypt and some Muslim communities in Toronto from Turkey. But these two, Indonesia and Pakistan, were our first two that we went into. So we're going to talk a little bit about the development of how this all got put together. This is all funded by a grant from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, the SHRC. The title of the project itself is Theistic, Agnostic, and Atheistic Notions of Evolution in Islamic Societies, Exploring Muslim Scientists, Teachers, and Students' Understanding of Evolution. That's the title of the project, and from that will come many different papers of different ideas. We had overall research questions that we wanted to look at throughout all of these different communities and hopefully beyond in future research. We wanted to look at how do Muslim students, teachers, and high school students come to understand evolution? In what ways do they relate evolution to their Islamic beliefs about the origin of life and human beings? How do participant teachers' religious beliefs influence their understanding and pedagogical practice related to evolution? And what are the objectives of a life science curricula in relation to evolution in these situations? Just kind of an overview of the data that's coming out of these different study countries. Overall, about 5,500 surveys from Canadian, Egyptian, Indonesian, Lebanese, Turkish, and Pakistani high school students. This is pretty good numbers. Over 5,500 are around there. And this is separate from the other kinds of data that you've seen before. These graphs that we've had about acceptance of evolution in these different countries, whether they're European countries or Muslim countries, those were generally done with adult populations. Doing research with high school students is very different set of difficulties, getting into the schools and getting into the permission and getting the trust of the students, and all of those kinds of things are separate kinds of issues altogether. However, this is a very important population because we're talking about the next generation of Muslim scientists, leaders, community members. So we're looking at the Islam community, the Muslim community to come in these places. We also looked at teachers. What are the teachers teaching? What are their thoughts about these kinds of things? And we did about 150 interviews with Muslim scientists, science teachers, community members, so people out in the community as well, getting an idea of what the broader idea was in more detail with these interviews. And we also did focus group discussions where we had several people talking about these things together and recording those conversations and drawing out what are the types of conversations they would have among themselves. We also had a lot of conversations between the Canadian, the Indonesian, the Pakistani, the Turkish, the Lebanese research collaborators. We got a lot of really good, valuable information just out of our own interactions that we're able to draw a lot of data from. Discussions with Muslim scientists and evolutionary biologists, the research scientists in these countries, to get an idea of how the practice of biology and the practice of science proceeds in these countries. And also, very, very important data came from the textbooks and the curricula used in the countries that we were looking at. So how did we go about looking at this stuff? Well, we did a lot of quantitative analysis, a lot of statistical analyses with SPSS and other programs. We did a lot of qualitative analysis as well, looking at the interview data and the discussion group data, those kinds of things. We coded them, coded the transcripts, did notes for central concepts, organized the codes into thematic matrices to look at what kind of themes were coming out of these things that were overall the data. We built a lot of profiles to say, you know, there are these kinds of people and these kinds of people and these kinds of people, and these are the kinds of things that we are common. And writing analytic memos when something interesting popped out of the data, we'd write that down and we'd analyze the kinds of, themes that would come out of those. We made all kinds of concept maps and things like that that would kind of draw out to the relationships between the different datas, and did cross-case analyses and used the constant comparative analysis to kind of method to give us an idea of how these different groups and different people would relate to each other in terms of their ideas. And there was a great deal of discussion of the notes and the interpretations and the things that we came out of there, and we said, well, all right, we have all this data, and what does it mean? And we had a lot of discussion between ourselves and between other people who knew the cultures and those kinds of things to kind of get an idea of, are we reading this correctly? Might there be some other things going on? And through these things, we think we have a pretty good grasp of what's going on as far as we've been in doing our inquiry. So, doing the construction of the surveys themselves was an immense process. You already heard Saouma talking about taking our French survey that was developed in Quebec to Lebanon, and there were already some issues there. But that was already after a lot had been done. We constructed this survey in English. We used a lot of questions that are commonly used in surveys, national surveys, and in the education literature in Western contexts, so that we could probably do some comparisons after the fact. And we translated these into Arabic for use in Egypt. We translated them into Bahasa for use in Indonesia. Translated them into French for use in Lebanon. Maybe it would be better suited for Quebec. We'll find out. We translated it into Urdu for use in Pakistan. Now, we looked at scientific and religious understandings as well as, we looked at their level of agreement to certain statements. So we had a lot of statements here, and they were 5-point Likert scale items that would measure a student's agreement or disagreement to certain statements to measure their understandings, both scientific and religious, about these different concepts. The translation protocol was actually pretty in-depth. We had 3 independent translations from qualified experts in English and the language of translation. For example, the first one we did was Indonesia, and we actually used a qualified, certified translator, certified by the government of Indonesia, to translate into Bahasa. We used some people who knew Bahasa very well, but who were also science educators and knew the way that the language is spoken in the schools. And we used somebody who knew more about science and was able to give us a translation in that respect. So we came up with 3 really good translations that we thought were really good, and then we bring those to a 4th person. So we take the 3 independent translation, and we get a 4th speaker who has expertise in science education and meeting the research, and they met with us, and we would talk about what do we mean to say, and here are the 3 translations, which one is the best to say what we mean to say, and maybe modify them slightly after that. And what we found was that each of the translations that came back independently would vary widely in terms of how they would try to ask what we were trying to ask. And so it was very, very important to go through this process. There were a number of terms that were particularly difficult to deal with. Some scientific terms, for example. The word evolution wasn't really easy to do, because evolution might mean all kinds of different things, and we had to figure out how are we going to specifically mean biological evolution, especially in a language where they might not have a word for evolution that is from that language, but it would be a word that kind of meant something like evolution that had to be specified, and then in parentheses have the English word that would go back to that, because that's the word that would be in their textbook. And so it was very difficult to get across the meaning of these in a reliable way. Ancestor was the same thing. There were several questions about the ancestors of different organisms, the ancestors of humans. And ancestor could mean all kinds of things. It could, in Indonesia, it could be your parents and your uncles, but it could also mean the Arabs, their religious ancestors, Abraham, could these kinds of things. Or in certain contexts in Indonesia, it could be the ancestors kind of the native religions that were there, the ancestor worship, the spiritual ancestors that are not part of Islam, not necessarily biological in terms of biological evolution, very different connotations, and each translator had a different word that might have specifically meant one of those different things. Related. When we're looking at, are humans related to other organisms? Are these organisms related to the, are all organisms related to each other? Related might mean something very different in one word than it might mean in another word. And some of the words that we had to put together to mean exactly what we meant. Very, very, very culturally laden. And the word supernatural was interesting because we were trying to use words that, we were trying to use questions that had been used in the West, and some of those questions would say things about, in science, should we use supernatural causation? Or is something supernaturally created? Those kinds of things. Should science include supernatural causation at all? And the interesting interaction that we had was that the students wouldn't see anything religious or anything having to do with Allah as being supernatural, because all nature is from Allah. All nature is Allah. And what is more natural than Allah? And supernatural had a connotation more less like what we would think of as supernatural, but more like unnatural. Ooh, that's unnatural. And they wouldn't want to attribute that to anything religious. And supernatural, specifically in Indonesia, might have something to do with witch doctors or those kinds of things where you would have the native traditions that might have, you know, magic of some kind. And that would be looked upon poorly by Muslims who were devout as something detracting from Islam. So they might very well mean that science should include religious explanations, but certainly not supernatural. So those are the kinds of things that we would run into and have some difficulty with. And there are also some very sensitive religious issues within this, where we would talk about, say, we want to ask a question about a text, a text. Where do you get your information? Does it come from a religious text? If your religious text is in conflict with science, or do you perceive it to be? And we were trying to be very careful to be open to people of all religions, especially in Indonesia, where not all students would be Muslims, but a majority would, of course. But we didn't want people to be answering negatively to a question that they disagreed with it because it was the wrong religious book instead of the concept that was involved. So we put in instead of the Quran or instead of the Bible, with the holy book of your religion, to be inclusive of minority religion. However, that kind of that gave students the idea that we had some type of Western agenda. Anila in Pakistan was asked often if she was a Christian because they weren't saying Quran. We also wanted to avoid difficulties regarding perceived questioning of the accuracy of the Quran. So it might be the kind of thing where we say, oh, well, should science include this, or is science in conflict with your holy book? And if we say the holy book, then people were less likely to get their hackles up than if we actually said the Quran, even though to them it was the same thing. In all the Pakistani translations, the independent translations that came back, where we had God, they put in Allah. And we wanted to be inclusive, and we ended up changing that back to Khuda. So there again, there was that thing that where they were saying, why didn't you just say Allah? So that's one of those things that we learned a little bit from. In terms of Indonesia, we looked at high schools in three urban sites. We looked at Singkawang, Padang Panjang, and Yogyakarta. So religion and cultural affiliations of our Indonesian collaborators was really important. It would have been a very different story if I had myself walked in as an obvious Westerner and tried to get into the schools to ask the Muslims about how they feel about evolution. We were very lucky. We had excellent collaborators who were here at McGill at that time, and then went back to Indonesia, and now they're working with the schools. They work at universities, and they work in the schools as science educators in Indonesia. So it was actually very important that we had local people who knew the cultures and who knew had connections. That was a very important thing, that they could get into the schools. As in terms of the ministry and the school officials, they were generally very cooperative. They didn't seem to have much in the way of a problem with us coming in and asking the questions that we had. However, the students, particularly in one school, they weren't always as welcoming because of some of the things that we saw, they might have seen in the surveys themselves. But at one particular school, students rallied behind their student body president who stood up and said, "Don't give that survey here. How can you believe we came from apes?" And we didn't give the survey there. That happened to be a madrasa. That just happened to be. We also did a lot of other types of schools as well. For Pakistan, the surveys, we did high schools in urban and rural settings in the Punjab and Sindh provinces. Lots of interviews with scientists, religious scholars, parents, and other community members. And the school administrators were really cooperative, but there were some concerns that were going on here. We actually went to the government first, and instead of giving us blanket permission to go into all the schools, they kind of left it up to the individual schools. The schools were fine, but they had some concerns, particularly because of the specific political environment that was going on at the time. Anila was actually in Pakistan right at the time that the cartoons came out in the Denmark newspapers, and there was uproar at the time, and it was kind of interesting for her to be there from Pakistan, but nevertheless potentially being seen as an agent of the West. So there was that kind of political thing going on at the time. So that's the context that we were in. And Anila is going to come and tell you what we found.
Thank you. Hi, thank you so much for being with us for several hours. And I'm just going to briefly share our main findings from Indonesia and Pakistan. And we are aware of the fact that these are very different countries with very different political and social contexts. But we are going to compare so findings from our surveys. I'm also going to share our findings from Muslim scientists who I interviewed in Pakistan, and then data from some Muslim teachers. Now, Pakistan and Indonesia are both Muslim majority countries. There are some similarities also. Pakistan, 95% Muslims. In Indonesia, they're about 85% Muslims. Both were colonized, but then they also have very different cultural traditions and very different political and social histories. And we are going to explain that more in our papers. This quote, I find this quote as representative of Muslim scientists who have found ways to reconcile, harmonize, evolution with their religious beliefs about the creation and origin of life. The similarities in DNA, in viruses, and even humans lead towards a particular indication, a creator who made these living beings through the evolutionary process. I am a practicing Muslim scientist. I won't accept anything against Islam. So if anything is against Islam, if evolution is against Islam, I'm not going to accept it. But if I am a zoologist, if I'm a biologist, if I'm doing biology research using the evolutionary model, then I need to find ways to reconcile both views. And we are also going to look at some more examples of the ways in which they've tried to bring them together to find a common ground. Another Muslim scientist said, Allah says, kun fayakun, be and it happens. The Quran says that Allah created everything in 6 days, but the length and duration of these days is not defined. So that helps them. Radiocarbon dating provides physical evidence in favor of Darwin's concept, a Pakistani Muslim scientist. So they were bringing up during the interviews, they were bringing up the physical evidence in favor of evolution that they are using to do their research and also teach their students. And they were also talking about their religious understandings of creation. Another scientist, a zoologist, said, personally, I don't see any contradiction between Islam and evolution. Human beings developed and evolved through different stages and attained their present form. Darwin never said that monkeys are the ancestors of human beings. They had common ancestors, and at some point the ancestral stock diverged. Islam is deen-e-fitrat. Islam says that everything is close to nature. And I asked them, you know, if they have discussions around, you know, the religious perspectives on evolution and the scientific perspectives, you know, with their colleagues. And most of them invariably told me that they try to avoid these discussions. They trying to avoid any kind of conflict around, you know, Islam. However, there were some scientists, one in particular from a major university in Pakistan, and she did not accept evolution. And she said that scientists take Darwinism as an opinion. It is not a fact. People, scientists with an Islamic point of view, disagree with this theory. Quran is the word of God. There is no compatibility between the religious and scientific views of creation. She did not see any compatibility. She was a marine biologist and she did not teach any courses in evolution. So she was doing her research, which was mostly focused on taxonomy, you know, and but she did not believe in evolution and believed in special creation. So just, you know, summarizing the findings, these are some of the main lessons that we learned from our interviews, that, you know, the Muslim scientists generally did not see any major conflict between Islam and evolution, and they tried to draw on coordinating the physical evidence and evolutionary theory and then looking at it in relation to their religious views. Okay, so the scientific the science teachers actually told us a different story. We interviewed about 25 science teachers, biology high school teachers in Pakistan, about 20 teachers in Indonesia. Our Indonesian collaborators interviewed them. I think most of the science teachers told us that they do not believe in evolution. We also found that, you know, they also did not have a very clear and a deep understanding of the scientific model of evolution as well. So they contradict, and most, although some accepted microevolution or evolution of other animals, they had major issues with, you know, human evolution. And some science teachers completely rejected it. But nevertheless, all agreed that there is no contradiction between Islam and science. So evolution actually was seen as the controversial issue. And they, most of them said that God gave us akal to think, reason to think, so we should explore the natural world. So, you know, how does it impact your pedagogical decisions? How does, you know, how do their own views about the, you know, scientific understandings, about the scientific model of evolution influence what they teach, what they decide to teach in relation to evolution? So most of them were in favor of using religious explanations in both countries, Indonesia and Pakistan. Many, and Canada also, you will see Canada or Lebanon coming up because we have data from all these countries and we've been trying to analyze it. But most of the teachers, even the Canadian Muslim teachers who are teaching in Islamic schools, said that they tend to include the religious, you know, explanations of the creation and origin of life in their teaching. And since the majority of them refute it, they tell their students that it is not correct, you know, according to Islam. Okay, and so in Indonesia we found that, you know, teachers tend to use the materials produced by Harun Yahya also. In Pakistan they are not using them. In Canada they were aware of Harun Yahya and his ideas, but they did not talk about using any of the materials. But in Indonesia they actually use the CDs and other books produced by Harun Yahya. So I'm just going to very briefly share with you some, you know, responses, students' responses to some questions from Indonesia and Pakistan. So, you know, and then we're going to look at their scientific and religious understandings of evolution and the confusion that these students, you know, experience in their understanding. So when we ask them, you know, evolution is not based on evidence, 54% Indonesian students and 60% Pakistani students disagreed, you know. So they thought that, you know, evolution is based on facts or is based on, sorry, evidence, and then some agreed also. We also asked them, you know, evolution is not a well-accepted scientific concept, you know, among the scientific community. But then, you know, 47% Indonesian students disagreed and 61% Indonesian Pakistani students disagreed because they thought that it is a well-accepted scientific concept. We collected 2,500 surveys from Pakistan and then about 1,300 surveys from Indonesia. So that's why these percentages make some sense, because of the large number of the surveys that we collected. So a large number of students actually, you know, 85 and 86% actually tended to agree with the statement that millions of fossils show that life has existed for billions of years and changed over time. It shows that they had some idea of the scientific, you know, some components of the scientific model. And then there were many students who actually disagreed that, you know, the earliest humans lived at the same time as the dinosaurs. Now, we don't know whether they mean that, you know, they changed or, you know, they evolved from other animals, or they meant that, you know, they just changed as human beings. So that is why, you know, follow-up interviews are very important to find out, you know, what they actually meant when they were answering these questions. There was another question about whether animals exist today in essentially the same form in which they always have. And there were about 48% Indonesian students who disagreed, 60% Pakistani students disagreed, which implies that, you know, they think that, you know, they changed. So let's look at what they think about human evolution. Humans exist today in essentially the same form in which they always have. And then there were about 52% Indonesian students who disagreed. 46% Pakistani students agreed and about 47% disagreed. So you don't see, the responses are fairly split, you know, in terms of, you know, the understanding, the students are really split among these choices. So you don't see, you know, one particular option coming out of these surveys. And I'm just going to show three more. And then there were some questions on that, on the questionnaire in relation to religion and evolution. So when we asked them, you know, do you think the holy book of your religion and science are in conflict regarding explanations about human origins? So 36% Indonesians agreed, and about 64% Pakistanis agreed. So they have some notion of the scientific concept, but then they have very different perceptions of how their religion views, you know, evolution, or how they should understand it in relation to their religious beliefs. Again, evolutionary theory cannot be correct since it disagrees with your holy book's account of creation. And there were about 60% students from both sides who said that although it is based on evidence, although it is a well-accepted scientific fact, you know, among the scientists, but it cannot be correct because it disagrees with, you know, my holy books of the Quranic account of creation, because in both countries we had over 98% students, you know, who were Muslims. There were only 2% Christians, so that's why we haven't, looked at the differences between the groups. And this is the last one. Your religion teaches that the first humans on planet Earth were created by God, not gradually, but suddenly in their present human form. And then you can see that in Pakistan, actually, a lot of people, about 80% students, thought that, you know, human beings were created specially. So you know, it seems that I will share my conclusions later. But before that, I'm going to share, you know, what we learned from our analysis of the biology curriculum in Indonesia and Pakistan. So the national curriculum in Indonesia includes evolution. It is a compulsory, mandatory concept that they are required to teach. It is taught in grade 12. And the standard of competency involves a good understanding of the theory of evolution and its implication to the environment. So that's in the national curriculum. Three kinds of textbooks are used currently in Indonesian high schools. One from a major publisher, one recommended by the Ministry of Religious Affairs, and one from a Catholic publisher. Both countries, Indonesia and Pakistan, have a centralized education system. They have ministries, you know, federal and provincial ministries, that control the curriculum or prescribe the curriculum. So all three types of textbooks in Indonesia, they cover the standard content of evolution, but they also contain some materials, you know, against the theory of evolution. and these are taken from books and CDs, sources, you know, that are advocating creationism. Then, you know, in the textbooks recommended by the Ministry of Religious Affairs in Indonesia, some Quranic verses are also cited. Okay, so then we also looked at the biology curriculum in Pakistan. So evolution is included in the biology curriculum. And then, but in all the textbooks, you know, for grades 9th through 12th, in all the four provinces, we found that, you know, they also had religious text, Quranic verses about the origin of life. And the most important and interesting finding was that, you know, they tend to support the scientific idea of evolution through the religious text. It's done implicitly and it is also done explicitly. I can share with you some of the Quranic verses that are included in these textbooks. So they use the first two actually to support the biochemical origins of life. Also use these to support the idea of macroevolution. Then, you know, the third verse, had there come upon man any period of time in which he was a thing unremembered. So the textbook authors, the biology and, zoology professors, who I interviewed in my study, they included these verses to convey the idea of human evolution. So they are, you know, emphasizing the biochemical, anatomical, and physiological and genetic similarities between human beings and other animals while interpreting these Quranic verses. So that was a very interesting finding. So, you know, what we found was that students are getting conflicting messages at different levels. The scientists tend to, you know, reconcile both. So when they write the textbooks in Pakistan, they tend to support evolution through the religious text. But the teachers do not accept it. And if they don't accept it, they tell their students, despite all these, you know, Quranic, verses and the interpretations, they tell their students that it is wrong. So students are responding to those conflicting messages also. That is why you see this, you know, contradiction between their religious and scientific understandings of evolution. This study has implications, like we have data from 6 countries, and it has implications for teachers in the Muslim countries from where we collected that data, but also for, you know, science education and teacher education in North America. Because, you know, we have now more information about the ways in which Pakistani teachers or Canadian Muslim teachers, Lebanese teachers, Egyptian teachers, or Turkish teachers, you know, may think about evolution, may respond to it. So we can address some of these issues in our teacher education programs. We can try to develop their understanding of evolution, because in the case of scientists, we found that, you know, if they understand the model of evolution, the scientific idea of evolution well, it was easier for them to reconcile both. But if you don't understand evolution and then you have a contradictory notion of your religious view, then you are going to oppose it and you're not going to teach it. In fact, you're going to tell your students that it is wrong. This study definitely promotes a greater, you know, dialogue between and among different countries. As I said, it informs, you know, North American K-20 science teachers. And then also it helps us to look at, you know, as teachers over here, I'm a science educator also, it helps us to look at the notions, the religious and cultural notions that Muslim students may bring to a science classroom. So, and that might help the teachers to first understand, identify and diagnose those notions, and then try to find ways to help them to understand the culture of science. Because research shows that if, you know, the student's family, you know, subculture is different from the culture of school science, or if the culture of school science is different from the culture of science, then students have a harder time understanding scientific ideas. So I'll just conclude there. Thank you.
Questions for Jason and Anila?
Oh, for one of them.
I don't expect too much. How many high school students do you think in North America or in one of these countries has ever seen a fossil or knows what is meant by fossil record?
Mm-hmm. So So that's an important question, and that's why, you know, when we talk about, you know, implications for teacher education or science education, we need to prepare teachers, and you by using these materials, you know. We need to prepare teachers. We need to expose them to these materials, you know, to develop their understanding.
In terms of have they ever seen a fossil, that depends on a lot of things. In some cases, it just depends upon the geology of the area where they live. I mean, but the other thing is socioeconomic status. I mean, are there museums where they live, and do they have access to them? What types of things do they have in their schools? Oh yes, that's an interesting thing. But the thing that pops into my mind from that is one of our people who was here at McGill had been sent here to learn about science education by the government of Indonesia. He was in a science education class here, getting a master's degree in science education. One of the questions he had for me was, "Are dinosaurs real?" He had never seen an actual fossil. Now he might have seen a picture. He might have seen a model, but in his mind, the word model meant fake. And he would say, oh, the ones in the museum, those are fakes, right? They're not real. They say model right there, right?
But I suspect that even in Canada, in the States, it wouldn't be a very good score for school students or university students.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen a fossil?
Yeah.
If they've had my class, they have.
Yes. Kind of an associated question. From what I've seen in like media results on similar surveys in North America, but not specifically with Muslims, but with the general population, the response rates aren't especially different, especially among students. From like what I'm remembering, I can't cite papers on it, but. Like, there's, even like in North American, regardless of religion, that the students have a very poor understanding, more often contradictory understandings of both evolution itself and how it interacts with their religious beliefs.
So you're saying students' views probably mimic their parents' views, and that misunderstanding of evolution is kind of universal and apart from age?
Focusing mostly on Islam, but it's not, I would say, it's not especially unique in some of the issues coming up with acceptance.
Yeah.
Right, there are many similarities.
Yeah, and we did a study here at the Evolution Education Research Center with, you know, elementary pre-service teachers here, you know, in Quebec, and we found very similar trends. Yes, it's not.
What is your response to the actual evidences we showed, like, for example, the bones of Homo habilis, Homo erectus, the evidence of Sahelanthropus tergensis, the ancestor of all of us? What is their response to these things?
Who is they?
I mean, the Muslim scholars and those who...
Well, the scientists, you know, the biology and zoology professors, they know about it. That's why, you know, they are trying to reconcile both. But teachers had a very, actually... I don't want to use this word, but had a very vague, superficial understanding of evolution. They don't even know about these terms. And we found this in many countries. And students, of course, I mean, these were high school students. They had some idea of natural selection, but they didn't know about these details because teachers haven't taught them also.
And in Indonesian classrooms, they may very well be seeing pictures of these fossils, but it might also be in Harun Yahya's books.
A lot of this data mimics, as you were saying, the Christian world. But before we did this study with the empirical evidence, we didn't know that. Mm-hmm.
So the symposium is Islam and evolution. And most of the studies focus on certain groups. And I can see why. Sexuality, education, etc. I just want to warn for something. This is meant as a constructive criticism. Many Muslim countries, including where I come from, a large proportion of the population is religious. Do you have any future intentions of exploring people who are not don't have any access to education, who actually are raising up a lot of children and who have some kind of say in terms of elections and in terms of the directions where the countries go.
Tanner, did you have some data on that you were talking about yesterday? Literacy rates and correlations with acceptance?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I thought I heard you talking about that.
I was talking about literacy rates, but that was a different context.
Okay.
There's definitely a need for this kind of follow-up study. But in our own study, we did talk to some parents also who were not necessarily highly educated, and they again had a very vague notion of evolution. They had just heard this term in some countries, and they thought that it was against Islam. But, you know, it's mostly based on interviews, so we cannot make any conclusive claims.
And we would love to do a lot more, but we need funding.
We need money.
So
we're going to pass the hat around.
Yeah. Please do.
Sure.
You said that a better understanding of evolution would potentially help Muslims to make sense of both their religion and evolution, and sort of incorporate both of them in their lives. Do you mind just giving a small, point form, what extra understanding would help and why?
Well,
I'm not certain I said that.
Teachers didn't have any idea of natural selection. A lot of physics teachers, even chemistry teachers, some biology teachers who had a master's in biology or zoology had some notion of, natural selection. And they didn't know much about the fossil evidence. They didn't know about, transitional fossils. They didn't know about the current debates or the current scientific evidence that is being generated every day. So, we still have to find out whether that would help the teachers or not. We are just making this claim, or explanation based on, what we learned from the scientists. Because the Muslim scientists, generally, most of them, who knew the evolutionary theory very well, they were making a conscious effort to reconcile both. But the other, they didn't have any idea about what it meant, and they also thought that perhaps it was against the religion.
So better understanding of it would make it easier for them to
perhaps that's what the literature, I think you can talk more about it, the literature over here suggests, in this part of the world.
Can I have a question?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. If generally you were to sum it up, would you say that evolution was included in the curriculum, but it wasn't translated well down to the students because of the lack of firm understanding among the teachers?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That is one. And then, students are generally, supposed to memorize the text because they have to pass the test, There is no free discussion generally taking place, around these issues.
But if they were given more information, or even in the situation where you did have some of the Quranic text included with the Bible textbooks, if people could reconcile between the two, they were more likely to understand the concepts of evolution.
That is our hypothesis, because there were two teachers in Pakistan, who really knew it well, and they were able to teach it well also, and college biology professors also. And then in the Pakistani or Indonesian context, they can discuss religion in class, because religion is, the religious text is included in their textbooks. So they can, address these issues also,
but
if they knew it.
Specifically, if you look at the textbooks, it's specifically delineated into Islamic concepts and scientific concepts. So mm-hmm. when they talk about origin of life, when they talk about evolution, it will say the section on Islamic concepts, and that's where you will find the stuff from the Quran. And it'll usually end up by saying, from these verses or from these sermons, then we can determine that life has changed.
Yeah.
And then they go into scientific concepts and talk about evolution the way they would otherwise.
But in some textbooks, they are very clearly trying to relate the two also.
Mm-hmm.
But there are separate sections. Yes.
It's a good thing or a bad thing from a teaching perspective in terms of wanting students in the future
I think an important difference is when you see people trying to put religion into the classrooms, the science classrooms in public schools in North America, it's usually to detract from evolution. Here you have a concerted effort to say, oh, well, this is okay with Islam. It's almost like a nod to Islam to say, yes, we are good Muslims,
Yeah.
And we can still learn about evolution.
Just one, and we have to, I think, need to understand it from, you know, Muslims' perspective also, because there we don't have this official separation between religion and science, church, you know,
church and state,
and then religion and science also, because it's a part, you know. So in their minds, Muslim scientists do not make any distinctions between science and religion. Yeah.
On this, it's continuing the same thing. Why it is, I know you don't know why it is. Speculate. Wildly speculate. The data bared out the case that most scientists at most universities, if you went in and heard evolution, did the same as McGill or Harvard being taught, pretty much. But if you went into the high school classroom, an incredible number of teachers were saying, I don't buy this stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, evolution didn't happen. Didn't those teachers go to those universities?
Yes.
Yes.
And that's a disconnect I'm really interested in. And it may be more common there, maybe from what we can tell, it may be more common there. But you see the same things sometimes in the U.S. where you have a lot of science teachers who are not exactly falling in line with what they've ostensibly been taught at